Christine Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
You with me on hoping it hits 90 today and tomorrow and the next day and the next day.
I'm kind of psyched.
So am I. You know, yesterday, Mark Fucarel of Stoneham became the last Boston Marathon victim to leave the hospital. Here's what he had to say.
Thank you to Mass General Hospital, especially, for saving my life. All the first responders, thank God for them. They did an amazing job that day. I want to thank my family for all my support. Looking forward to my next step. I feel good. You know, I feel positive. I'm happy.
He says, I feel positive. I'm happy. Mark, if you don't know, lost one leg. They're attempting to save a second as he goes to Spalding Rehab. He went on to say, this is my favorite part, he went on to say that his plans are to dance at his already planned wedding. I mean, it's unbelievable. Everybody knows that tens of thousands of people and businesses have contributed almost $38 million as of this morning, One Fund Boston. A lot will be added tonight when that all-star cast of musicians and comedians, most of them with local ties, by the way, perform at Boston Strong at the Garden, leading the all-star cast, one of the greatest bands ever, Boston's own Aerosmith. Joining us on the phone is the bassist for the band, Tom Hamilton. Tom, thanks so much for giving us a few minutes on Boston Public Radio.
It's more than a pleasure.
Hi, Tom.
Hello.
I'm wondering, where were you when you heard about the bombings at the marathon April 15th, a little bit before 3 o'clock in the afternoon? You remember?
Yes, I was in a car on my way to the airport to go and leave on our tour of Australia. First time we've been there in about 20 years. But we were just starting to get down near the downtown area when, you know, we heard on the radio that there had been a loud bang or an explosion, but, you know, it was still, people didn't really know what was going on yet. We knew that we had to take a wide turn to get around the area, and by the time I was on the plane, you know, I'd seen CNN on the monitors in the airport, and, you know, everybody had finally realized what was going on, that this wasn't it wasn't a gas explosion or something like that. It was actually a deliberate attack, and flew off to Australia knowing that that had just happened and didn't hear another word about it until I got to Australia 15 hours later, and just incredible. Seeing the magnitude go from what is that to, oh, my God, it's this huge, horrible thing was very uncomfortable process.
Tom, did any of your bandmates or you, did you know anybody who was at or near the finish line for the marathon?
No, I don't know anybody, but I have talked to a few people since I've gotten back that were close by down there.
So, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, well, they all say the same thing, you know, when that first noise happens, everybody looks around and assumes it was, you know, a gas main or something, but then when the second time happens is when, you know, that feeling of dread comes about where everybody realizes that something deliberate was done.
So I'm wondering, Tom, how'd you get from there to performing tonight? Is it something you guys all decided together, or did someone contact you? How did you wind up being among the performers tonight at the One Fund Boston concert?
Well, we were contacted by the organizers, and the way I my experience of it is that it was pretty automatic. I remember thinking that if there was any type of activity like this, that hopefully the band would be involved in it. You know, we love Boston. This is where we, you know, went from becoming adolescents to becoming adolescent men. And,
we love
that.
We're
very attached to Boston. Yeah. You know, I love it here. I've wanted to be here since I was 12 years old, and I still love being here. And, it was it's a wound for the whole city.
You know, Tom Hamilton from Aerosmith, my understanding is from Jimmy Buffett to Carole King to Jay Giles to Stephen Wright to Dane Cook, you guys, everybody's doing this on the house. Everybody's donating their services so that all the money's raised goes directly to One Fund Boston. That's correct, right?
Absolutely, yes.
And so when I know there's the Boston connection. Obviously, as you say, you felt a personal connection to this whole thing. I assume you guys are asked all the time to do this sort of things for fundraising efforts that matter. How do you say no to other things when you know, obviously this one's special? How do you say no? How do you people say no?
Well, a lot of times it's simply because our time has already been planned out, you know, months before something like this comes up, or another type of fundraising concert. We just something that Aerosmith hasn't participated in a lot. I think everybody in the band individually has causes and foundations that they like to support, but we generally don't do it in an organized way where we do a special gig for a certain event or group.
Is it for you guys? Obviously, everybody knows how huge you are. Is it particular amount of fun for you when you know you're sharing the stage with this whole spectrum of very different kind of performers, but virtually all of whom are at the top of their game? Is that fun for you guys?
Yeah, well, it's definitely fun for me. I love the irony of it, you know, about the idea of us being on the same bill with James Taylor, you know, and some of the other artists. But the thing that I do love about it is that we're all going to be smiling at each other and shaking hands and enjoying that, you know, we've been given this opportunity to try to help out with this. It's, you know, I feel... It's just such a terrible feeling to think of the suffering that was caused by these two violent people, and anything that we can do in any way to counteract that horrible, violent, you know, source of whatever this is a privilege and an honor.
We're talking to Tom Hamilton, obviously the bassist for Aerosmith. One of the most incredible things, we just played sound for Mark Fugerill, who is one of the most seriously injured. And I don't know if you've been around the last couple of weeks, Tom, but when you watch on television or on the radio, you listen and you hear the positive message, the strength and the courage of people who are sitting in front of a camera without a leg that they had a month ago, I have to say, amongst the most impressive and inspiring stuff that I have really ever seen.
You know, I see that too, and it really is incredible. I don't know how a man who has just lost both his legs can go in front of a camera and talk about what he's looking forward to. I thank the Lord that there is, you know, something inside us all that's capable of doing that. You know, I'm concerned for a lot of these people that, you know, someday all the excitement's going to die down.
Yeah.
And, people aren't going to be talking about it quite so much. And that's when these people, I think, are going to need the most support.
Amen.
So it really needs to be a sustained effort to help out and, you know, really help these people to be able to follow through on their feelings of the idea that the future is going to be good.
We're talking with Tom Hamilton from Aerosmith. How do you guys decide what the playlist is going to be tonight?
Well, we're doing kind of a classic, you know, we're only doing a few songs,
yep.
Unfortunately. So we kind of stick to the ones that go out back to the beginning and, you know, one more recent one. It's not really that hard. You know, we know if we're going to play five songs,
yep.
Which ones are going to, make people the happiest. So that's what we want to do.
Is Sweet Emotions going to be on the list, which I know you had something to do with, Tom Hamilton?
I believe, yeah, I think we are playing Sweet Emotions,
great.
As a matter of fact.
Great.
You know, what I wonder, because I've never been behind the scenes at one of these concerts, especially when you got you guys and you got Carole King and Jay Giles Band and, you know, all these people. Do you have like a buffet going on back there? if so, is it like pasta, salad, or cheeseburgers? Or is it too upsetting to eat before you're going to go on and perform?
You know, I don't think this band has ever done anything without a deli tray nearby. Just kind of expected to be there.
Yeah.
Really funny. Yeah, I'm sure there will be some kind of buffet, although my tour manager says don't count on there being a lot of it because we're not spending a lot of money on the luxuries for the bands. It's all going into the fund.
But do you have the deli plate before you play or after you play?
Oh, you can't. If you're going to eat before the show, it's got to be at least a couple of hours before because you don't want to be up there running around burping up salami the whole time.
Never stopped us, Tom Hamilton. I want to be clear. Hey, Tom, before you go, you talked about some of the classics. Are you aware of the battle that's going on Beacon Hill where they're now deciding, the legislature is now deciding what should be the official rock song of Massachusetts? And it's between Modern Lovers, Roadrunner, and Your Dream On. Do you know about this deal?
I do. And, you know, it has gotten so much coverage and so many people have asked me about it. It makes me want to just pick up the phone and call our publicist and say, why don't you think of stuff like this? it's really funny how that has dark and now people still ask me. And, you know, we're ready to really get down and go to battle with the modern lovers.
Absolutely.
We'll absolutely destroy them.
Destroy them. Give it to them, Tom. No question about it. Hey, Tom Hamilton, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. We appreciate it. And I hope it's a great concert.
And thanks for doing what you're doing tonight, Tom.
My pleasure, and thank you, guys.
Tom Hamilton from Aerosmith, one of the obviously the lead act at tonight's all-star performance at the Garden.
And you can see him tonight, as Jim just said. And if you cannot get to the concert, you can watch it live here on WGBHnews.org. We will be streaming the whole thing. Okay, you know,
what, is he a decent guy, or is he a
great
decent guy? I mean, he's great.
Yesterday, Jeff Bauman, who is one of the survivors from the marathon, he lost both his legs there. He threw out the first pitch at Fenway Park. Certainly, he deserves that honor. But in most instances, the first pitch has kind of devolved into this, you know, from the high-ranking officials like President Kennedy and President Bush and President Obama to Hello Kitty and a robot. Wither the first pitch. Sports columnist Dan Shaughnessy joins us next for that conversation. Stay tuned to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad on the next Radio Lab.
I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And welcome back to Boston Public Radio. You know, throwing out the first pitch at baseball games is a century-old tradition. The other night, Carlos Arredondo, the man in the cowboy hat, and Jeff Bowman, the man he rescued, who lost both legs at Marathon Monday, threw out the first pitch together at Fenway.
Jeff Bowman, over the last couple of weeks in Boston and a victim of the marathon bombing, is Carlos Arredondo brought him out as he did from the finish line and brought him out here to the pitcher's mound to throw out the first pitch.
Okay, gentlemen, it's your moment.
And then there are other moments when the first pitch is thrown out by things like a monkey or Miss Kitty. Here to discuss the evolution of the first pitch is Globe columnist and author of the great bestseller, Francona, the Red Sox Years. And by the way, you do not have to be a Red Sox fan to love every page. Welcome to Boston Public Radio, Dan Shaughnessy.
How are you, Jim?
Excellent.
Hey, Dan.
Hey, Marjorie.
So that was a pretty moving moment the other night where you had Jeff Bauman and Carlos Arredondo. But has it been kind of debased when they're not great moments like this? What do you think, Dan?
Well, I think it has been diluted. That was an interesting piece that the Times had on this the other day. And I was curious, you know, the Red Sox are playing in New York this weekend, Yankee Stadium, for three games. I'm going to those. And they only do it, they've held back. They only do, I don't know, 12, 15, 20 a year. And yes, that was a little more special when it was a little more selective. And it's become, in some instances, maybe a little bit diluted and commercialized.
Well, you know what I was surprised at, that there's some deal. The Times piece talked about it being part of sponsorship in some cases, where you're a sponsor, and then you get to be out there throwing the ball, and that's really kind of tacky.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want, like, this guy's here because he's really rich or because he sold a lot of computers at the last convention.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
You know, the one thing, you know, I'm on the board of UNICEF locally, and I know that we have had that item as an auction item, and you know, and you get really rich guys who want to be out there throwing the ball, and I think that would be the Red Sox response if you got Dr. Charles Steinberg on here, the choreographer maestro over there, to explain why it is they do what they do. I think they would say, well, greater good, this has value. Yeah, probably it's diluted, it's not the President of the United States, but you know, people, a lot of people can benefit from this. So It depends on which side you're looking at it from, I guess.
And by the way, that's where it started. I didn't know this till I read the piece, too. In 1910 or something, a president started throwing out the first pitch, and they did over and over again. And then the evolution happened. So are the Yankees the last holdouts, Dan Shaughnessy? Are they the only purists? Is everybody else doing whoever makes sense throwing out the first pitch?
I think it's the latter. It dominates. And again, this is we live in a country where the hot dog races, the running presidents at seventh inning stretches, like,
I love those.
A big ticket item. And I think it is the norm now. I understand it. And it does go back. You know, the piece pointed out how in the old days they threw the pitch from the boxes. Which the Red Sox did honor that. When they had the 100th anniversary of Fenway, they had Caroline Kennedy, whose great-great-grandfather, Honey Fitz, threw out the first pitch. I guess he'd be her grandfather. At the first game at Fenway Park in 1912, and of course it was done from the boxes then. So that was kind of nifty the way they honored that and kept it that way. And being on the mound does lead to some bad moments. Although I'll tell you one, after the towers fell in 2001, I was in Yankee Stadium, and George Bush, God bless him, he had a vest on, a bulletproof vest, and there were snipers on the roof of Yankee Stadium all over the place. It was a moment. He went out there. He had warmed up with Derek Jeter. And he gunned a strike there, and it was electric. That was that's really the best one I can remember.
You know, Marjorie and I agree. We didn't see it live. We saw it in the HBO documentary. And speaking of that, there was this documentary about 9/11. Here is George Bush himself describing throwing out that first pitch. It was Game 3 of the World Series in 2001.
I took a deep breath and threw it, and thankfully it went over the plate. And the response was... overwhelming. It was the most nervous I had ever been.
That's great.
It's the most nervous moment of my entire presidency, it turns out.
How great is that?
It's a little scary.
But you know something, Dan? This is how I feel. I remember we saw it in the movie, the documentary. I think it was a Billy Crystal documentary.
I'm wrong. 61.
And it was a documentary about the Yankees and the Mets after the towers fell. But when you go out and see people, I mean, like Obama totally blew it when he went out and did
that.
Did he bounce it to home plate or something?
It's bad.
It was very bad. So you kind of feel like if George Bush hadn't thrown a strike, then we were going to lose against the Rockies.
Right.
You know, it's like when your kid's up there in high school in the batter's mound, you know, he's hitting a pitch. Why can't we just do it? Why put that added pressure on everybody? Because lots of people, especially some of these old athletes that, you know, aren't in their prime anymore, why can't we just throw it from the stands?
It wouldn't be the worst idea, and I guess it's the better camera shot, and there's more exposure, and you know, you're on the pitcher's mound, you're kind of out there where they're doing it, so I understand that. But in a lot of cases, it's not for the better, and particularly, as you referenced, Margie, when you see, you know, a guy who was, you know, great in your eyes when you were a kid, and he's out there, and, you know, it's like seeing, you know, someone, you know, dribbling their cereal down their chin. not the way you want to remember your great heroes.
No. And it's how hard is it, by the way? I mean,
it's hard.
It is hard, isn't it?
It's a lot further than it looks. The mound is a lot higher than it looks. And then, of course, you only get one shot, so there's the nerve-wracking aspect to it, you know. So, yeah, I think that it's definitely not as easy as it looks. And those of us who would be asked to do it would pause before making fun of others.
We're talking to Dan Shaughnessy, Globe columnist and the co-author of the bestseller Frank Cohn of the Red Sox Years. So while I'm shaking my head whenever we talk about the purest approach to this with you and Marjorie, I'm thinking this. So Dan Shaughnessy is 90 years old. He gets a phone call from Curt Schilling, and he says, let's bury the hatchet, Dan. Let's go out on the mound as two 90-year-olds and throw the first pitch. Do you say yes or no, Dan Shaughnessy?
I would be afraid he would hit me in the head with his phone, so I think I would probably decline that offer.
Hey, Dan, before we let you go, you obviously wrote this great book that was a top bestseller, New York Times everywhere, the Francona, the Red Sox Years. Terry Francona, and by the way, I love him more after I haven't read the book. I loved him when he was the Red Sox manager. He returned for the first time as manager of another team with Cleveland the other day. What kind of reception did he get at Fenway?
Well, to no surprise, I mean, he's a hero over there. And, you know, like a lot of things, the longer you've been away, the greater you get. And the way things went south in a big way after he left enhanced his image and his reputation over the 8 years here. So he's really walking on water over there now. Fans love him, and it's kind of a repudiation of ownership maybe losing its way a little bit. And he's the hero, and they're not, and that's the way it is right now. But that'll all change. If the Indians get good and competitive and give the Sox a hard time, the Sox continue to play well, he'll be the enemy again, just like Johnny Damon and you know, Adam Vinatieri and other great people who did great things here who come back with the other side. But right now, his stock's very high over there, and they loved him.
Hey, Jen Shaughnessy, one last thing from me. You've been watching baseball forever, I know, and first pitch is probably not that much attention paid to it, but I'm just wondering if you have a sense over the years. Is it like a 30-70 ratio, 30% manage to get a strike, 70% don't? I mean, how does it work? Do most people goof it up, or is it 50-50 or what?
You know, it's a case by case, and depending on who it is, you cut them more slack. And
yeah.
And sometimes they stand in front of the mound, or someone's assisting. There's all different things, but what you don't want is a recently retired, healthy looking player really looking bad, or somebody trying too hard and having it go in the wrong direction. But for the most part, I think we're understanding of the specifics of that person out there, and everybody cuts some slack.
Can you throw underhand if you're...
Marjorie.
You can, Marjorie. It's like Will Chamberlain with the free throws. I'm
exactly.
Sure you
okay.
Hey,
okay,
I'm
just
a Philly
to check.
Boy. I remember. Hey, Dan Shaughnessy, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank
great
you,
talking
Dan.
To you guys. All right, take care.
Dan from the Boston Globe, great sports columnist. And you got to get this book, I'm telling you.
Oh,
sports
so
fan
talented.
Or not, Red Sox fan or not, Francona, the Red Sox years, which he obviously co-authored with Terry Francona. Okay, all you baseball purists out there, should the first pitch be limited to people like presidents of the United States? In that moment with Bush, George W. Bush was one for the ages. Marathon heroes like Jeff Bowman and Carlos Arredondo a couple of nights ago, I think Tuesday night at Fenway. Or is it okay to have corporate sponsors, a guy who sells the most used cars at a particular agency, or even Hello Kitty? Our number is 877-301-8970. You know, I'm a traditionalist in this regard. And when I read the New York Times story and I read a little bit about the history, which I know you'll share with us in a second, and you saw presidents throwing out the ball. And then it wasn't at the game, but I saw the video of Arredondo and Bowman the other night. It was so moving. Leave it there. You know, if it turns out you're a corporate sponsor or you're on the sideline, let them go shake David Ortiz's hand and get a picture. But I sort of feel it should be reserved for what it was intended to be.
I want it.
Some great ceremonial honor, no?
I want it to go back to the way it used to be.
We
just
what?
Threw the ball out
from the stands.
I find this much too stressful.
You even know, though you're not doing it.
Yes, because like I said, you're worried if you're superstitious at all. Suppose George Bush blows it, or Barack Obama got up there and he threw a lousy pitch.
Did Keith Lockhart tell us a few weeks ago
differently about the President of the United States?
Did Lockhart say he had done it a couple of weeks ago when he was here?
So.
I think he did.
I think so.
And but it's funny you say what you say. I never did it, nor will I ever do it.
You have to
but
practice.
I feel the tension now when you're talking.
If I said that, anybody who's got a kid in baseball, whether they're in Little League when they're 8 years old, I mean, it's awful if your son is the pitcher because the whole game is just ruin for you every time the kid walks somebody because they throw. So to have someone that's important to get up there, or to have some person that's just a regular Joe or Jane get up there and really screw it up, I mean, I'd never recover.
Okay,
I would never recover.
Do you know that not only have cartoon characters thrown out the first pitch.
Monkeys.
I was just going to say, animals
monkey.
Have thrown out the first pitch. Cirque du Soleil, and to get you in the mood, and I think this will convince a number of you to move into the purest position where I am, at a Los Angeles Dodger game, they had this life-size replica of what's the cartoon character? Hello Kitty. My apologies. Thank you. Hello Kitty. I mean, please throw out the first ball. Listen to the sound. It's just such a turnoff. It's ridiculous. Here it is. This is the background music while Hello Kitty is going to the mound to throw out the first. I know I feel like a fuddy-duddy over it, but there's certain place. Hello Kitty can sit in the dugout as far as I'm concerned. Hello Kitty should not be thrown at the
How
first
about
pitch.
My idea?
What's up?
Why do we have to have everybody in the pitcher's mound? Why can't they be throwing the ball out from the stands?
Well, Marjorie, you're not doing it. If it turns out they're willing to use the pitcher's mound, let them use the... we saw
I'm
some of the video on the New York Times
careers
story.
Careers can be ruined over this, Jim.
Who was the first... What does it say in the story? Well, who was the first president to do this in 1910? I don't even know who
Taft.
The president was in 19...
It was Taft.
Taft. And then we saw a video.
William Howard Taft is believed to have been the first president. And then John Fitzgerald, who was the mayor of Boston, known as Honey Fitz, of course, that would be JFK's grandfather, threw one out before the first official game at Fenway Park in 1912.
Well, we also saw the video of on the New York Times website. Dwight Eisenhower, I think, was thrown out the first pitch, threw it from the stands. Also, you're always looking for form. Do they look like they can really do it? JFK, who also threw out a first pitch from the stands, looked like he'd been a lifelong major leaguer. I mean, he really got got it right. It was almost perfect.
He threw it from the stands.
He threw it from the stands, yeah.
How can you get it right throwing it from
the stands? Because your arm movement, unlike Barack Obama, who, as you've said on more than once, and by the way, Marjorie said this, not me, he threw it like a girl, she said. And, of course, he bounced it on the way home. 877-301-8970. So where do you fall on this issue? Are you a purist that says ceremonial first pitches of baseball games should be reserved for presidents, for marathon heroes, those sort of people, or are you okay with Hello Kitty and that sort of garbage?
Kim in Cambridge, what do you think, Kim?
I think that we should have more just regular folk who are doing good for the community, like someone who does good things for kids, someone who helps the elderly. It could be a teacher of the year. It could be a cop. It could be a nurse. I'm just tired of people being able to buy their way in and have it be based on class or money or status.
Yeah, that's a good idea. The teacher of the year, the regular Joe, some of the and then you could take the pressure off because then they could stand 10 feet away from home plate and just kind of toss it underhand.
No,
that's what
so.
I would do.
You know, but Kim used an expression, Kim. I'm glad you did that. We didn't use we used a polite term like corporate sponsors. They're buying. She's right. You buy the ability to do a first pitch, and there's just something wrong with that. Kim, that was an excellent call. Thank you very much. You remember George in the car who called yesterday?
Mm-hmm.
George called yesterday. He was the guy who sold those disinfectant products. He
yes.
said the first pitch should be thrown out by whomever sells the most Purell is what his position is. He just called it a minute ago. It's not quite the spirit we're trying to.
Didn't we debunk Purell yesterday? Didn't we talk about all these studies that show
we did? I don't think it moved
anybody. It's not going to save your life if you douse yourself in Purell every morning before you come to work. What do you think about the first pitch? Should it be regular Joe's? I mean, Kim had a great point. Teacher of the year, or should it
I
be?
I like it.
Should it be reserved for presidents or governors? I mean, why politicians really? I mean,
well,
how come
because
they
the people, Democratic, small D, democratically elected in the lead, and it's sort of nice. And you know, it's also nice since baseball, even though it isn't the national pastime anymore, football is much more popular sport. It's sort of nice that the person who is leader of the free world gets to do that thing, no?
I guess.
Remember
it's
Devon Patrick
better,
told us?
Imagine if they had to go out and hit a field goal. Imagine that. That would be so humiliating. That would be like in Snoopy,
can kick a field.
You know, when Lucy pulls the ball.
Remember Devon Patrick asked us? He called us that Saturday after the marathon.
Yeah.
And he was on his way to Fenway. The first responders are being honored. And do you remember, I believe he told us how nervous he was. Maybe this is after the fact. He told us that he was going to be asked to throw a pitch out. He didn't have to, I believe. But it is true. Your whole MO like collapses if you bounce the ball to home plate.
I think differently about Barack Obama. He missed a bunch of free throws. He's supposed to be a basketball player. Missed a bunch of free throws a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
Then he bowled in the campaign the first time around. Lucky that didn't mean he lost the election. Remember he got like a 72. No, not a 72.
It was like a
68 42.
Or something. It was pretty pathetic.
And was it big balls or candle?
I can't remember.
I mean, it's really embarrassing if they were big balls and he got like a 60. That would be really
And remember, as Chelsea just reminded us, in yesterday's tire toss at Point Pleasant on the Jersey
That's
Shore
right.
with Chris Christie.
That's right.
He went 0-for-5 and Chris Christie was 1-for-1.
Sean in Denham.
Hey, Sean.
Hey, guys. How are you today?
We're
Good.
Excellent. What's going on?
I have a, Jimmy and Madre, I have a list of people who should never. Eddie Markey, I never want to see you. Barack, that was embarrassing. Roseanne Barr, stay away from my baseball field. Here's the people, Jimmy, that should. George W. Bush after 9/11, as you've talked about.
Beautiful.
Was unbelievable. Jeff Bowman, fabulous. Patriots Super Bowl, any cancer survivor. And Jimmy, anyone who paid $8.25 for a beer, they should just line every one of those people up and just say, hey, you got one pitch, let's go. I mean, are you kidding me?
Hey, you know, on a serious note, by the way, if people didn't see, Bowman lost both his legs, as everybody knows, and then Carlos Arredondo, the man in the cowboy hat, he was with us a few weeks ago, too. Bowman threw a perfect strike to Salta Lamaki, who's the catcher for the Red Sox, and Carlos threw the ball to David Ortiz. I mean, is that unbelievable or no?
Jimmy, can I ask you a question, Jimmy?
No, I don't think so.
Have you ever thrown a ball the first pitch?
No, I have not. I've been waiting by the phone, and as the old saying goes, if the phone don't ring, I know it's for me.
Marjorie, I'm guessing Marjorie to be like a girly man.
Maybe so, maybe no.
We don't want to know the truth.
Sean,
so
thanks for the call.
Wah-wah.
That's great
that's
to talk to
you. Thank you,
you
Sean.
So much, Sean.
You know, we should just tell people, in case they don't know, Carlos Arredondo, the cowboy hat man that was pushing Jeff Bowman in the wheelchair after he lost his legs in the marathon, he jumped into the national consciousness a while ago when his older son was killed in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And when the troops came, the soldiers came to his home to tell him, he set himself on fire in his van. He survived that. And then he drove the van all around the country protesting the war with his son's boots and some of his memorabilia from the service. And then he lost his second son, not in the war, a couple of years ago. His son had a drug problem and stuff. So this man has lost two sons. There he is at the finish line of the marathon. He's an incredible
person. I'm so glad you said that, because for most of the world, the only way they know him, which is an important way, is the guy with the cowboy hat who did this heroic, mm-hmm. courageous thing, saving or running to the help of Jeff Bowen. And by the way, to his credit, since his son was killed in Iraq, he's become practically an internationally known peace activist with his wife. And they have been relentless in that pursuit. And now he sort of adds another quiver to his, or whatever, an arrow to his quiver? What is that thing called?
I think it's an arrow to your quiver.
I think that's what it is. He added it. Whatever it is, he added it. Let's go to Groton, where Kristen is on the phone. We're talking about ceremonial first pitches and whether or not they should be reserved for people, you know, Boston Marathon heroes and presidents, or are we willing to cheapen it a little bit? Hi, Kristen.
Hi, how you doing?
Excellent.
Good. And by the way, Dan Shaughnessy was from Groton, which is kind of a funny thing, but
that's right.
Yeah, he's not that loved around here, though.
Why is that? What's the matter with him?
Because he talks more than he does. He's not a big expert. I guess this book's supposed to be good. Maybe he can write, but whatever.
Well, let me just say, number one, I've read the book. It is fabulous.
He's very talented.
And number two, he's maybe the best sports columnist in the United States, with all due respect to the Herald. Putting that aside, go ahead, Kristen.
Yeah, the locals disagree. But, okay, we think that anybody should throw the pitch out. It's a sport. The guys aren't playing because they love Boston. Johnny Damon left, before the glow dulled off the World Series in 2004, who cares? Okay, so it's business. If you sell the most cards, I think that's more heroic than playing a game for millions. Everybody wants to do anyway. My hat's off to the car salesman. Let them pitch.
Kristen, that's an excellent call, and if anything would move me, you come pretty close. Our number is 877-301-8970. The reason we're talking about this is because the New York Times did this brilliant piece a couple of days ago talking about the evolution, for lack of a better word, of the honor of the ceremonial first pitch and how it started with presidents. You said Taft was the first one in 1910.
William Taft was
done it subsequently, but obviously it's expanded. Nobody was upset. In fact, everybody celebrated the other night with Bowman and Arredondo on the mound at Fenway when they both threw out simultaneous first pitches. But when it gets, I still, as great as Kristen's call was, I still want it for special occasions and special people, even though she makes a great point. Who's more of a hero? Johnny Damon, who left for the Yankees for what, $15 million a year? Or her husband, who is a champion used car salesman? I guess that's a good question.
Well, some guy that sold the most Dodges in the lot, didn't he get an opportunity
to
throw out the first pitch at one of these baseball fields? Yes, I believe he did. Kevin in Nashua, New Hampshire. What do you think, Kevin?
I would be fine with the sponsorship for the first pitch as long as it would impact the ticket prices and make it more affordable for a family to bring their kids.
We missed the first part of that sentence. Say it again, Kevin.
Okay, I would be all for sponsorships for the first pitch, as long as it would impact affordability of tickets for a family to bring out their kids to a game.
Well, you know, that's something I could be able to. So, for example, how many seats are there at Fenway? 34,000 or something? If it cost a corporate sponsor, let's say $34,000 to throw out the first pitch, and that took a dollar off everybody's first hot dog or something, that's actually a constructive way to schedule this whole thing. I sort of like that. You don't like that, Marjorie?
No, I guess so. I do. I mean, it is really expensive to go to Fenway now. It costs you a fortune.
Kevin, thanks.
It costs you a fortune. And the whole, I'll say one thing for Fenway, though.
What's that?
You know what? It is great that even on game day, you can drive right through Kenmore Square when the game is beginning. And the traffic is not that bad. You might be held up for one or two blocks. Isn't that terrific, Jim?
You know, that in 1990, when I was leading a ballot campaign that we won, but it was not wildly popular, mm-hmm. throughout with the we were trying
to raise
to prevent,
everyone's taxes.
No, it was to prevent a huge tax cut, which is unaffordable. Uh-huh. I'm driving with my campaign chair, the guy, I was the head of the campaign, he was the chair, right past Fenway during, this is a true story, and people saw us and they tried to turn our car over. So That's a totally true story. I forgot about that until you just talked. You know, one of the other great things about Fenway, which is really not our topic, is also downtown.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many places around this country. If you want to go to like a football game in Foxborough or a baseball game, you have to drive an hour. The beauty that it's downtown, you can take the T, you can walk, it's just fabulous. 877-301-8970. We're talking about the first pitch and how it used to be a great honor for presidents and real heroes, and now it's sort of anybody who sells a couple of cars.
Well, Sean would want to bar Roseanne Barr from coming to the
You know
stadium.
Why? Do you remember Roseanne Barr? What'd she do?
Because of her disastrous rendition of the national anthem.
Maybe the worst. Arguably, she, who's the great Olympian sprinter who may have one of the worst ever? What's Carl's last name? Carl Lewis. Did one of the worst. We should actually do a segment on this at some of the worst performances of the national anthem. And they're legion, by the way. But Roseanne Barr is right up there. Remember what Roseanne Barr was doing as she was singing the national anthem?
She was sort of scratching at herself.
She was grabbing her
That was very bad. I think it's also very bad if you forget the lyrics. I can relate to that because you might be in a panic. But imagine getting halfway through the national anthem and you've forgotten the words to the rest of the song.
You remember who the most famous example
that is? In front of 50,000 people? No, who?
The most famous example is Muhammad Ali. He may have been fighting Sonny Liston. I'm not sure, but it was a Muhammad Ali fight. And a guy who I don't think is with us anymore. Remember Robert Goulet? Robert Goulet sang the...
Robert Goulet? Played Sir Lancelot?
He did.
See, Camelot?
Yes, he did, on Broadway. He sang the national anthem, and I would say it's safe to say he forgot 75% of the words.
Ah!
It was epic.
Could Julie Andrews ever perform with him again, Jim?
It was Carol Lawrence. Oh, you mean from Camelot?
She was in the movie.
She was.
She was in the movie. I don't think she could sing. All right. Before the marathon, you guys may know about this, and if you don't, it's a fantastic story. We're going to tell you about it. Right before the marathon, Brigham and Women's Hospital approved leg transplant protocol. Procedure, in theory, that could help a lot of the Boston bombing victims who are now double amputees. We're going to talk about that procedure, where it's at, with a physician from the Brigham when we return. This is Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad on the next Radio Lab.
Well, it's certain. I mean, it's.
Are you sure?
I don't know.
I mean, yeah, well.
We've got stories from that surprisingly razor thin line between certainty. And doubt.
Tonight at 10 here on WGBH Radio.
You know.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Lahey Health, committed to providing leading-edge care right in your community, helping you become and stay healthy all through your life. You can learn more at LaheyHealth.org. That's LaheyHealth.org. And American Experience, their relationship prevailed through the greatest tragedies a marriage and a nation can suffer. Don't miss Abe and Mary Lincoln, A House Divided, Thursday at 9 on WGBH2.
You are listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. The doctor who's about to join us is the director of transplantation surgery at Brigham and Women's. He did the first full face transplant ever in the United States. The reason I'm laughing is when he last joined us, what was it, a month or two ago, to discuss that work, there was fear at WGBH that Marjorie was ready to quit to become his personal assistant. Luckily, it didn't happen. Now we read, as you heard a couple of minutes ago, that people at Brigham Women elsewhere are looking at limb transplantation, specifically leg transplantation, which takes on special significance in light of the marathon bombings. Joining us to discuss that work is Dr. Bodum Pamahak. Dr. Pamahak, good to talk to you again.
Thank you for having me again. Good afternoon.
Hi,
doctor. So where are we in terms of being able to do actual leg transplants at the Brigham?
Yes. Well, the idea came in the context of tripod injuries frequently seen in Iraq and Afghanistan after the soldier steps on a landmine or IED. They typically lose lower extremities and one of the hands. And many of them were candidates considered for hand transplant, but in the context of missing also lower extremities, it seemed natural extension at no extra cost except labor and the actual operation, but at no extra cost to the patient to also consider lower extremities. And that's how the concept evolved to what we currently have, which is protocol allowing us to perform combinations of transplantations of both upper and lower or even isolated lower extremities.
Dr. Baumbach, my understanding from the Globe story, which I read a day or so ago, is that there have been a couple of these leg transplants done in the world so far, none in the United States, but there have been dozens of arm transplants. Why so far ahead with arms and still so cautious with legs?
Right. I think it's a great question, and you would probably find as many opponents as people that are excited about this potential new horizon. I think in the big picture, it belongs to the tissues that we simply cannot restore. But on the other hand, unlike hand prosthetics, where the dexterity is paramount and where many of the prostheses lag behind, lower extremity prostheses actually work quite well. And that's why if we think of the pros and cons, the risks and benefits, the jury is really out there how much we hope we can help our patients and how much we really will.
So you have to, in other words, let me put words in your mouth, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong. You have to be convinced, and I mean the generic you, in addition to you individually, that a leg transplant would be a major, I hate to use the pun, step ahead of a prosthetic device. Is that where the ethical issue arises?
Yeah, you could say that way. I think that we have a fairly significant competing technology, meaning prosthetics, and we would ideally be able to prove that transplantation turns out to be better. And again, the jury is out there, but I think that what we can provide is restoration of sensation in the foot. We can provide the wholeness of the body. You know, it's not easy for bilateral lower extremity amputee to go in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, for example. And we hope that we'll provide the body expenditure level of normal, which is a big issue, actually, in the whole picture of amputees patients, where the expenditure is remarkably increased, and it's one of the contributing factors why the patients die earlier.
We're talking with Dr. Boden Palmahot from the Brigham and Women's Hospital about the possibility in the near future of having leg transplants done here in Boston. I didn't realize this until I read this piece in the Globe either, Doctor, that if you do have a prosthetic device, you do have to, most people take it off when they're sleeping, they take it off when they're showering, and they have to be replaced every 3 years.
Right. They are frequently replaced. They are not inexpensive, and they still require frequent fitting and maintenance. So it's not a sort of a worry-free device. And, you know, from the recent survey that one of my colleagues organized, we've learned that through the Coalition Amputee of America, that patients are perhaps not as happy as it may seem. They function, but they're not as happy with the prosthesis.
Are you getting a lot of since the story ran, and obviously the story made clear that your work on this, the investigation you and your colleagues have been doing, preceded Marathon Monday, has there been a lot of outreach in your direction from survivors of the marathon who lost one leg or two?
Well, not really, to be honest, and I think it's probably good. I think those patients have a lot to get through psychologically, mm-hmm. as well as physically. So I think that even though we would be happy to discuss it with them, I think the time is not right for them to even consider procedure like this until they're further out and they have perhaps tried prosthetics that are available.
You know, a lot of us, we saw the Blade Runner, who of course got in trouble when he allegedly has been charged with killing his girlfriend, the South
Oscar
African.
Pistorius,
yes, yeah. the great runner in the Olympics. We saw that and I thought, my God, this is amazing. But of course, his was a different situation because he had lost his legs at birth, I believe, or when he was a child. So is that why he was able to do so incredibly? And that's not really a picture of what it could be like for a person that lost their leg in the marathon or through another reason?
Well, it certainly raises a whole set of good questions. There's no doubt that the earlier deformity or impediment occurs in your life, the better you are going to be able to adapt. So someone who has been born without, and you may have seen this, without hands, can use the dexterity of legs and develop it to the extent that none of us can later in their lives. So there is probably a component of that as well. And from that standpoint, probably the pediatric or children transplants will functionally do best, just like they do best in terms of hand surgery or lower extremity surgery in general.
And so the people now that are facing recovery from the marathon injuries, they're talking about a year or so before they're in any close to being able to get around easily with the prosthetic. Is that about right?
It's probably around 6 to 12 months.
Six to 12 months, okay. Now, you have a gentleman that we read about in the Globe from Brookline who is a possible candidate for having his a leg transplant. Tell us about him.
Yeah, so he's a wonderful man who's approached us, or was actually sent by one of our colleagues when he was at the Boston Medical Center in rehab. And not only that he's very intelligent, but he's also getting very well. He understands the concept of what we are trying to do, and he's sort of the right match for a study like this one. In his case, however, because he lost all four extremities, unfortunately, we're going to proceed with the upper extremity transplant first, and that will provide him with some time of adjustments, but also learning what life is like on immune suppression before we would proceed with lower extremities later on. And the reason for staging it is that it still is a big operation that we don't quite know whether it would be even safe to perform all four extremity transplant, and it may be exceeding our abilities at this time.
You know, the gentleman in question had a strep infection. I assume this is extremely rare that will result in your losing limbs?
Right. It is, fortunately, very, very rare. But we have seen about half a dozen patients with a similar problem, variety of etiologies, variety of reasons why they got the strep or flesh-eating bacterial infections. And in all instances, the body is essentially trying to centralize the blood flow to maintain the heart and brain at the expense of the periphery. And that's when the hands or lower extremities or all of them may just die out. And it's unfortunate, but it's one of the defense mechanisms that our body mounts in effort to fight the life-threatening infection.
We're talking to Dr. Bodin Pamahak. He's the director of transplantation surgery at Brigham and Women's. He did the first full face transplant in the U.S. I hesitate to ask you this question, doctor, but both times we have spoken to you throughout the conversation, I'm standing here shaking my head at the wonder of all this. Do you ever go home at night, and I know it's your craft, do you ever go home at night and say to yourself, this is really unbelievable? I mean, I'm serious. I've given a full face to people who had none, and we've seen the images, we've seen the interviews, and now you're about to cross this next horizon. It really is unbelievable.
It is amazing, and I feel incredibly fortunate to even be able to have it happen in my professional life. I think many of my colleagues and people in other professions would probably only dream about opportunity like this. And I just hope that we really can provide to our patients what we hope for. I hope that we'll really help them. And I don't really spend much time thinking about what an amazing thing it is. I'm thinking of what next may either happen to the patient, worried about them, or what may be the next in the big picture application of this technology or surgical principles that we are laying down.
We'll spend time saying how amazing it is while you're doing your work, Dr. Pamahak. Hey, doctor, both in the 70-plus arm transplantations that have been done, and in the two, I know it's a limited sample, leg transplantations elsewhere in the world, what percentage, I don't know if I'm asking this properly, what percentage of normal functioning does the average patient, starting with arms, get back? What percentage?
So the percentage widely depends on the level of amputation. The closer the amputation occurs to the hand, to the wrist, the better the outcomes, mm-hmm. to the point where amputation perfectly at the wrist may have near perfect outcome.
Really?
But the farther you go up, the more damage occurs to the muscles that move the fingers, and the farther the nerves have to regrow to actually allow for motion, and the results are progressively worse, so that patients that have high amputations, let's say under the shoulder joint, really get fairly rudimentary function, elbow flexion, some degree perhaps of hand function, but that even grasp can be quite unpredictable. But they all do get sensation.
So do you expect the leg to be a similar sort of outcome?
Right. The interesting thing about leg is we don't really worry as much about the fine motor function of the toes. It's not functionally critical. What we do want is function of the knee joint and ankle joint, ideally. And I think that in that comparison, it's a little less complex problem than hand transplant, and therefore I would hope that the outcomes will confirm that this is obtainable and patients will be able to walk again and feel their feet. Yeah. Which is important for sort of prevention of injuries.
We're talking with Dr. Bowden Palmahawk from the Brigham, where they are close to doing possible leg transplants. You mentioned before, Doctor, that the hand transplant can be almost perfect. So if I were looking at someone who had a hand transplanted and the scar had gone away, would I notice? I mean, the skin color might be different, or the one hand would be different than the next. I mean, would you look at it and think this is their hand, or would you notice that it's not their hand?
Well, I have to share with you my own personal experience shaking a hand with a hand transplant patient from Poland who had the perfect level at the wrist, and I could not tell. I'm perfectly honest. He could make a fist. He could spread the fingers. He felt everything. It was perfect. And certainly the surgery must have gone very well, and they've done an excellent job. But the level of amputation, because most of the muscles that you really use to move your fingers are up in your forearm.
Right.
So if you have adequate length of tendons, the patients immediately start moving and can get very good function right from the get-go. The question is later on recovery of the fine motor sort of muscles in the hand itself. And those are the ones that help you to spread fingers, put them together, and do sort of more fine motor function or more fine motor action with your hand.
Dr. Palmahawk, what's your sense of the timetable? I know you can't be precise, but what's the time frame within which you think the first leg transplant is going to be done by you all or other doctors in this country? What's your sense?
Well, I think we are probably looking at about a 6-month horizon or so, maybe even a touch longer. It depends. We have identified a number of quadra amputees, and as I've mentioned, they would be done sequentially, so the hands are still functionally more important and would be performed first. But there are several patients that would be potential candidates for lower extremities in the future among those. We have not really, you know, the story and the recruitment hasn't really started, so we're looking at sources of funding. We're looking at potential recruitment of patients, and it's going to take a little time. So 6 months is probably the earliest.
You mentioned funding, and I read this in the piece as well, that when we talked to you about the face transplant, you had to kind of convince the Brigham that this was so new and so experimental to kind of go there. So again, I would assume this is a situation where you're probably your Blue Cross, your Harvard Pilgrim is not going to pick this up, correct?
Yeah, they would certainly consider it experimental. And, you know, we are writing grant proposals,
yep.
and we're trying to secure funding for this aspect of surgical innovation. So I'm hopeful that within that certain the same period of time, about 6 months, we'll be able to get some funding as well.
You know, we saw a follow-up story. We spoke with you about the face transplants operations that you've done before. We saw a follow-up story of one of your patients from Vermont who was disfigured and went through a face transplant. Saw a picture of her looking fantastic, and now she's got a boyfriend and seems to be just – she's having a wonderful – tell us a little bit about her.
Well, we have seen it actually now in two patients. One of them got married this past, I believe it was February or March, Dallas Wins from Texas.
Wow.
And he met his wife at the burn support group. They were both burn victims, obviously differently affected, but it has resulted in their union and marriage. Carmen has a wonderful man, boyfriend Sheldon, who I had an opportunity to meet, and I think that she also is getting her life back to the extent that she may not have hoped for before. And that's, of course, exciting for us. We really cannot wish for more than patients returning and living happy lives.
By the way, I hate to be a self-promoter, but my colleague at New England Cable News, Jack Thurston, did an interview with that couple that was one of the most beautiful 2 minutes I've ever seen. If you go to NECN.com, you can search it. So, Doctor, before we let you go, I know you're not yet at the leg transplant phase. You said 6 months plus away. What's next? I assume if I had met you 15 years ago and said, will there ever be a full face transplant? I assume there would have been some skepticism, a leg transplant, the same thing. What can you not do? I mean, what's the next horizon after legs?
Well, you know, in that context, we can transplant pretty much any sizable block of tissue of a human body. So whatever is missing, we could replace. I think the question is going to be in the context of immune suppression for the rest of the patient's lives, what is really worth to replace that way or not? And until we solve the problem of either minimization of the immune suppression or possibly completely elimination, which I hope our research will contribute to, then we'll be still weighing the pros and cons. Once we get to that point, and who knows, it could be in 5, 10 years, it could be in 15 years, then you could imagine that we could transplant individual fingers that are missing, small parts of a body, because the immune suppression no longer will be an issue. And we can technically do that now. It's just that it's just not worth subjecting patients to immune suppression for that. So that's kind of the big picture. In the immediate horizon, I could imagine that we can transplant, again, tissues that cannot be otherwise replaced. And that can range from abdominal wall to trachea, or there have been even patients that have got transplanted uterus. And urogenital reconstruction is a huge problem as well. So transplantation of the male genitalia is something that we're considering for the future as well.
Dr. Bowden-Pomahawk from Brigham and Women's, thanks for your time and thanks for your terrific work. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Yes, great to talk to you again, Doctor. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, thank you. It is a thrill. Dr. Bowden-Pomahawk is the Director of Plastic Surgery Transplantation at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. Okay, up next.
Is it unbelievable? I'm sorry.
Yes.
Do you listen to the end of that conversation?
Like you can be like bionic.
There's nothing.
Your whole head.
You know what I love about him, too?
What?
The humility and the just matter. I don't mean matter of factness in a negative way. He just goes about his work. And he's terrific. He's really an impressive man.
I can't balance my checkbook when he's transplanting limbs. It's just unbelievable. Okay, up next is Christopher Lydon. He joins us every Thursday at 1 o'clock for Open Mic. He's going to join us today to give us his take on what every high school graduate should have acquired learning-wise before they graduate. That conversation is next, 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Summer with the WGBH Spring Auction.
Time is running out to bid on some fantastic deals like electronics, jewelry, vacation getaways, and more.
Even a brand new Toyota Prius, donated by your New England Toyota dealers.
And every winning bid supports the programs you love.
And be sure to tune in for the live TV auction June 2nd on WGBH2.
Bid high
and bid often
at auction.wgbh.org.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Citizens Bank, presenting sponsor of the 2013 Boston Globe WGBH Summer Arts Weekend, July 26th, 27th, and 28th in Boston's Copley Square. You can learn more at bostonsummerarts.com. And Payne Boucher Fine Builders, 30 years of building, restoring, and renovating homes in New England. Committed to sustainability. More information available online at pbbuilders.com.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. It is graduation time. Harvard's today. I actually got stuck in traffic at a Harvard Square. Colleges and high schools this month and next. Joining us to discuss what's missing for many kids' education that needs to be restored to produce a whole child at the end of the process is our Thursday Open Mic guest and the man behind RadioOpenSource.org. That, of course, would be Christopher Lydon. Hello, Chris.
Good day, Jim. Good day, Marjorie.
Okay, Chris, what's missing?
The expressive arts, and we're going to talk about it. We get to beat Oprah to the punch here by, 45 minutes.
She's speaking at Harvard for those
who don't
know.
Nobody asked me for a commencement speech, but this is what I would say to the kids, to the parents, to people like me. Make art every day. That's Amanda Palmer's sort of slogan. And if possible, make music. And if possible, make music with others. Make every kind of music the core of the high school curriculum, and everything else will follow.
And by the way, that is in many high school curricula, this has been cut back or eliminated because because of the standardized tests, you got to focus on that. So that arts education and related kinds of things have really taken a backseat.
I think there's a big turn coming, and I'd love to hear from listeners, callers, about their own family experiences. But basically, what I'm learning from my own grandchildren, especially my eldest, who's just graduated from Boston Latin School, is that you can learn calculus from Khan Academy. With a good teacher in school, you can learn the rest on Khan Academy. You can learn Arabic. You can learn a lot of biology. You cannot learn interactive, interhuman, give and take of a that you do in an a cappella singing group or an improv group or in a string orchestra or a chamber, much less a chamber quartet. My God. And that is the model of real life interaction. This is the way companies get built, ideas, political parties, movements, almost anything interesting gets done. Restaurants, you name it, is in the small attachment of people who are listening intently.
So what do you think? Is the obstacle been just dollars, or has it been lack of appreciation of anything except straight book learning?
It's several things. And I'm an example of what was wrong, Jim, and you guys may be too. I mean, I went to Roxbury Latin School. Chris Hayes of NBC has written about this, interestingly, because he came out of the same sort of Hunter College, test everything, go, go, go. We were built for speed. Not for expressive power, not for, you know, the kind of intimate depths that we hunger for now. I've done a lot of my own sort of makeup with piano lessons of my own, but I'm not sure. One of the things Chris Hayes has said, and I think it's fascinating, is that part of the problem here is the finance model of absolutely everything. The, you know, take it out to the 11th decimal point, and that difference is all important in whether you get the job or you don't. No, it's not important. These are false values. The ranking of everything, the wrong priority on the basis of sort of numerical measures. This is insane. And compared to people learning each other's reality, I see it in my blessed granddaughter's a cappella group at Latin school. I mean,
do they have band? I mean, can you learn to play the clarinet or the violin at Boston Latin School?
Amen. Look, there are nine instrumental groups from three string orchestras.
But you have to learn it someplace else?
No.
You can learn it in the school.
There's a marvelous young guy, Willens, Jean Jules is his last name. He hadn't played the trumpet until he came to Boston Latin School. He's now the best high school trumpet player in Massachusetts, and they've just won a big competition in New York among big bands playing some Charlie Mingus stuff. I hope we can hear a little bit of it. But the point is, no, the instruments come. There's a marvelous guy, one of the real unsung heroes in our town, Paul Pitts, about 15 years ago, started a huge turnaround at the Latin School. And he's expanded his staff. They've got, as I say, nine instrumental groups, nine different kinds of singing groups. The a cappella groups, male and female, sort of manage themselves. They write their own music, a lot of it. They certainly arrange all of it.
So, what did you say a minute ago? You hope we can hear. Hope we can hear some of what?
Well, I'd love to hear some of this Boston Latin School big band.
I just want to ask you one question. So Boston Latin is in the same school system as every other Boston public school. How come they can have all this stuff there and they're not having it at South Boston High?
It's not a big deal. They can do it because they had the accident of hiring Paul Pitts 15, 20 years ago. He went to Latin school himself. He's built up an extra outside the school support system for his program. He's added to his staff. Kids get volunteer coaching on particular instruments from Berkeley kids. I was there yesterday, just kind of drinking it in. It's a magic space, and I'd like to talk more about it. I'd also like to talk about the other things that, to me, are sort of straws in the wind. I don't know if you caught it, but there was a funny little Chelsea Clinton end of the NBC News warm and fuzzy feature with a young guy named David France in Boston. He's a first-rate violin player himself, black man who's starting. His ambition is to build a black orchestra, string orchestra for sure, in Roxbury, and something like Ben Zander for African Americans and others. But he approaches it with a huge zeal, tremendous spirit, and the kids drink it up like it was manna. It's just an extraordinary scene.
Let's hear some. Tell us one more time before we play. What are we hearing?
We're hearing, this is a almost random selection from the Boston Latin School big band playing in New York, I think, in a Mingus competition.
Here it is. Does that make you smile or what? But, you know, let me say, the place where I disagree with you is not the end game. I hate that expression. I don't know why I used it, Chris Lydon. But if, who was the Secretary of Education with us a few weeks ago? Matt Malone.
Is that great.
Is his last name Malone?
Malone.
I hope it is. I hope it is. And my apologies if I got it wrong. Hmm. My guess is if he were sitting here as part of this conversation, what he would say, Chris, is you're right, but you're wrong. The place where you're wrong, it is about dollars. I would include that, I think he would say, in every curricula if I could. But the reality is there's a limited number of dollars and cents. When I think
I say he's wrong. Here's
why.
Because you just got to change the priorities. I would say, for starters, and this sounds a little kooky, radical, but think about it. Make the expressive arts like that. And there are many others, all sorts of theater and whatnot. Make that the core of a high school education and everything else.
Make that the core of a high school education.
Yes. We're coming here to bring out your performance, your inner life, your expressive skills. We're going to build them up. They are skills. There's a wonderful sort of ethic over in the Paul Pitts world in which he basically says, our rule is it's work and desire, work plus desire equals success. Talent helps, but it's not the essential thing. Kids don't come in inspired. They learn to work at these things.
Let me give the phone number.
I would say to the education secretary, make the expressive arts the core of a high school education. Everything else should be extracurricular.
Fine. So let's see at 877-301-8970. Who agrees with Christopher Lydon? I thought where you were going, Chris, was that this has to be added to the curriculum. Your position is it should be the centerpiece of the curriculum. And let me add one thing.
I think that's going to be a tough sell.
Let's assume the secretaries of education, whoever, the generic secretary of education, says, I'm with you to a point, but we have to make sure that the kid knows how to make change when he or she is working at the cash register in high school. But some people
there are.
There
no cash registers.
Well,
anymore.
Whatever they are.
Everything's on a card now, Jim.
So I may have to add a few dollars. And the question is, do you think the average person listening to the show or the average person in New England would say, I'd be willing to pay an extra couple of bucks if I could achieve both things? Get the core traditional curriculum that I am used to and add an additional, if that's not the ridiculous, an additional core curriculum, a parallel core curriculum in the arts. You think people would pay for that?
I think so, yes. But let me give you one of my little, this is my sort of thing I think about walking down the street.
Yes,
one of my little hobby horses. What if, instead of teaching 20th century American history, you taught and played our culture, the culture we grew up on, as the story of two incredibly powerful and fruitful migrations? Eastern European Jews basically coming to this country and African Americans coming out of Jim Crow into the North, to California, to Chicago, to Detroit, to Boston, to New York. And when you hear John Coltrane play My Favorite Things, you know, that's Richard Rodgers out of Eastern Europe and John Coltrane out of Hamlet, North Carolina.
So you are teaching history.
Of course, you're teaching what actually the fundamental, you know, tensions, differences, individual histories. You're teaching blues culture and you're teaching, in some cases, Yiddish culture, in some cases, high European harmonic music. And this is the story of almost everything we know about
this
country.
We're going to get to the phones in 1 second at 877-301-8970. Had you been elected mayor when you were, what year was it, 1990? What year was it?
1490.
Whatever it was.
Yeah.
1990 was it?
Yes.
What year is it? Okay. Had you been elected mayor, what do you suggest, despite your passion or the odds, that you could have convinced the school committee that that's what they should have done in Boston? And by the way, it was elected in those days, not appointed. But still, what are the odds you think you could convince a majority of school board members to go in the Chris Lydon direction?
It's easily done. And moreover, it's coming. I mean, we can't afford the education, certainly at the college level, even at the high school level, we say we can't afford it. So how do you stretch it out? How do you get the dynamism and the core and the social values in a classroom, in a music studio, on a stage, and you go online for the rest? I mean, I think this is sort of a missing connection that we haven't made with online education. There's an awful lot of stuff that you can, as I say, get there.
We agree.
My grandchild, did extraordinarily well in her mathematics, but she did a lot of it online.
Well, the other thing is that you can learning these things at a very early age matters, like language. You need to learn music when you're very, very young. It's very hard to be a 35-year-old starting to play the piano, I've always thought. And the other thing is...
I was 37, Marjorie.
Okay, well,
I
it's
still
hard.
Can't play, but
it's hard. It's hard. And
thus proving
it isn't Marjorie. Very expensive to have an a cappella group. I mean, that's just... You need someone to help you arrange the music. You need someone
no, you
to
don't.
Teach you. It's not like having to go out and rent the trumpets or
but, you
rent
know,
the
I have
clarinets.
To, I want to come to halfway to Chris's point. We've discussed online education with Kara Miller and others almost nonstop in
right.
here, and we've discussed what's the appropriate mix. And Chris Lydon makes sense in terms of how to make it affordable is the things that don't require the same level of human interaction and contact you do through online and this other stuff you do here. Let's take some calls. Melissa in Barrington, Rhode Island. You're on with Christopher Lydon on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Melissa.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent.
Good. I find his comments quite interesting. I have a daughter who's just about to turn six. She's finishing kindergarten, and she's been doing an art course, you know, like camp here and there, and ever since she was, like, not even four. And, you know, it's so much. They learn so much from doing something like that in terms of cooperation and thinking outside the box and just thinking on your toes and
Amen.
Imagination. And it is wonderful, and unfortunately, they don't really have time to, you know, promote those things in school. And I'm an educator.
That's the sort of segue that I just can't accept. What do you mean? But all it's great. It's teaching their humanity. It's making them blah blah happy or better. But we can't do it because we're gonna go back to school.
Right. I mean, I wish it were integrated more. I guess is a better way of putting it. But the way things are going now in terms of testing, it just strips those things away. The creativity and the thinking is kind of stripped away, and it's more...
You got to rebel, Melissa. You just got to say no.
There you go. Right. As Chris Lydon makes inroads in Barrington, Rhode Island. Melissa, thank you for the call. 877-301-8970 is our number.
More charter schools. That's my idea.
Okay, but fine.
Can I just say another
thing?
And you hear it from Melissa. What you see in the Latin school, what she's seeing with her own child, is what we've known certainly from Bach onward in his little instruction manuals. What we're seeing in these kids is music as the art, maybe the only one, or the ultimate one, that trains fingers and thumbs and ears and these giant ideas that we call harmony and dissonance and counterpoint.
Sports do that?
Yes, indeed they do. Indeed.
I think music helps with math, too, usually.
No, it helps with everything. I loved Yehud Menuhin, the great violinist, was also a great teacher and built schools around the idea that all our human capacities come together. Coordinating the imaginative, which the football doesn't exactly, the spiritual, which basketball doesn't exactly, the nervous system, memory, history, the music of folk tradition, which is glorious, but also the music of individual genius. And in the Boston schools, specifically Latin, you also see this incredibly healthy swath of Westies, the kids from West Roxbury, and the Southie kids, and the Roxbury kids, and the Mattapan kids, and Jamaica Plain, Charlestown, you name it. Working hard, listening to each other, developing something slowly, and also their experience a kind of steady improvement in their own work.
I want you to know, by the way, just so I'm smiling, not just to you, Christopher Lydon, but I'm looking at a picture from last year. Yo-Yo Ma is performing with the drummer of Guns N' Roses at Capitol Hill in Illinois, at the Illinois State Office Building, advocating for greater integration of the arts into the core curriculum of the
public schools
of Illinois.
Integration, but that's sort of, again, it's kind of lip service, Jim. I go
lip service.
Two or three. No, in the sense of, what if you just said, no, we got the priorities wrong. What's happening in the music band room is more important than what's happening in a Latin class where nobody's listening.
You just trashed Yo-Yo Ma. Are you aware of that?
No. Yo-Yo can do no wrong. But I go two or three times a year to this bash that the Latin school has. You know, it's an all-evening, 7 till 10:30. And every musical group performs. And I'm always saying to my grandchild, you know, sweetie, you're living in high school heaven. This is the best. I mean, you could not imagine a better place. All the groups, all the different kinds of parents, all the different kinds of kids, there's almost nothing left out. What if you said that is the core experience you're going to remember when you're 30, when you're 70? put that first.
Let's go to Julia in the car. You're on with Christopher Lydon, Boston Public Radio. What do you think of the Lydon curriculum, Julia?
Good afternoon.
What instrument would you like to play, Julia?
Pardon me?
What instrument would you like to play?
None. I was never very musical, so maybe
you don't have to be. I just heard E.O. Wilson, the great scientist, saying the other day, it's a myth that scientists have to be mathematicians. You can hire mathematicians. Learn what you can learn.
I understand that.
Go ahead, Julia.
That's not my point. Here's my point. Okay. I agree completely that we need to get the arts more prevalent in our schools. However, my 22-year-old or whatever she is, granddaughter just graduated from the University. University of Oregon with a degree in international studies and a minor in Spanish, and she does not know how to write a complete sentence. She's got an invitation, and she doesn't know how to match plural nouns and plural verbs.
You are singing my tune, Julia.
Oh,
you are so right. It's awful.
I have another story. I went to an award ceremony, baccalaureate, last night, and when they gave the award for the English department, the English teacher said this infuses into. I'm like, no.
So wait, Julia, is your basic point that we have to teach more basic things
before we
get to Christopher Lydon's?
I don't think we have any priorities that make sense. You can talk about this not making sense, having the arts, but we certainly don't prioritize how to write well, how to speak well. None of that.
Well, the Boston Latin School is unusual.
Call, we appreciate
that's
it.
Unusual in that, but that's gone out the window.
No, look, I want to say to Julia that there's a wave coming. You know, everybody knows now about the Venezuela El Sistema program, of which the core is fundamentally that, you know, every child born alive will get a violin and learn to play it. And
is that a figurative notion or a literal notion?
Not to the last infant, I don't mean to say that, but there's a mass education in string playing, and Gustavo Dudamel, a product of the program, is now the conductor, an incredibly charismatic, revolutionary conductor of the Los Angeles Philharmonic. Our new BSO conductor is a child of that trend, but educate everybody in expressive music, in music that they can play. And of course, there are other things to learn, including language and writing, and, you know, maybe you should take that grandchild, Julia, and set him down. I used to say to my kids, apply the seat of your pants to the seat of your chair and stay there until it's a complete sentence that you can, you know, you can stand and deliver.
Christopher Lydon, they don't teach grammar anymore in the schools because you're supposed to get it through osmosis. It's crazy.
Wrong.
Barack Obama says between you and I instead of between you and me, and he went to Harvard.
This drives me crazy, I must say. And in the New Yorker now, I mean, you know, cigarettes taste good like a – oh, Winston tastes good like a cigarette should, and the whole like business. But we can recover from that. But I think the most important thing in this insecure, finance-driven, ridiculously numerical culture we've adapted, you've got to say to the kids, look, it'll be great for you to build the skills that will get you a job. It'll be greater even to build the skills that will sustain a career. But you're working on a life. There's a difference between a job and a career and a career and a life.
Chris Lydon is glaring at me. Mike from East Bridgewater, you are next on Boston
Public Radio with
Christopher Lydon. Hi there, Mike.
Hey, how you doing? Well, listen, I have to disagree completely with Marjorie.
Oh,
I'm in the Chris Lydon camp.
Okay.
I started playing classical piano in my early 30s. I am now in my mid-50s. Last week, I had a piano recital at the Longy School of Music, Pickman Hall. I played Brahms, intermezzo.
Mike, you're my dream.
Congratulations.
Number one, from memory, on the stage.
Congratulations.
Now, bless your heart, Mike.
As a busy adult, I'm a doctor, and I have a very busy practice. It really tests your time management, self-discipline. You know, you have to get up, and you have to practice. This stuff is not magic. You have to build every day in your daily schedule. When do I get to practice? Is it 30 minutes? Is it 15 minutes? Is it an hour? And you make that part of your routine. Just like
Mike,
breakfast,
that's so
and you
beautiful.
Go to bed. It's the same thing with music. It is not an option. You know, eating is not an option. Sleeping is not an option. Music making is not an option.
Mike, that's beautiful.
Listen to your passion.
Mike, run for mayor. Take it all over.
And then hire Chris as the superintendent of the public schools.
That's impressive. That's Mike, hard to do. That's hard to do.
I want you to get in touch with me. Find me on the web, will you? I want to be you. I want to celebrate you.
RadioOpenSource.org is where you find. Let's squeeze one more in. Mike, you're in Foxborough. You're on with Chris Lydon, Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. Hey, Mike.
Hey, folks. Thanks for making time for me.
Pleasure.
You know, your earlier point about it being quantitative, you know, life in general in the society, you know, music is just as equally quantitative as, you know, finance or economics, let's say. But I guess my issue with the thesis is that school is not supposed to be fun. I mean, it's not supposed to be this adversarial environment.
John Silver lives in
I was going to say, if you're not crying, if you're not in pain, you're not learning.
Balloons, and now we all have a cappella groups, which, you know, again, it's important,
like
but it shouldn't
guy.
Be the focus.
Mike,
you know,
thanks.
I'm sorry, but I really have an issue with your thesis.
Okay, literally, John Silver, who I was quoted, didn't John Silver say something like, fun is overrated or whatever it is?
Well, there was a famous Nora Ephron interview when he was still in Texas. I mean, before he got here, he said, if they're not weeping, if they're not actually in torture, like, it's not worth it.
He was the president of BU, and prior to that, he was at Texas. So wrap this thing up for us, Chris Lydon. What's the basic message of the day?
Make art every day. Look into, deep into the eyes of your exquisite children and realize that there's an expressive soul in there dying to not just get out and scream, but to learn the techniques, learn the disciplines, as Mike in East Boston. I mean, spend the time every day to add to that expressive message, and you will live a very happy, productive, well-rewarded life. That's what it's about.
Chris Lydon, great to see you. Thank you so much.
Christopher Lydon joins us every Thursday at 1 o'clock. Tune in tomorrow at this time for Open Mic with Emily Rooney. Christopher Lydon, the hot weather's here. How do you keep cool? Are you an AC guy? Are you opening the windows
and
fans? No AC,
no. We weren't meant to be Just go with it. And then the weather will change.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk
keep
about
practicing.
That. Because the heat is finally here. And lots of people do want to stay cool in the summer. So how do you do it? That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
You gotta get an internship to get a paying job, but new graduates considering unpaid internships maybe shouldn't.
Students are basically receiving a negative wage. It's worse than working for free. They're actually paying to work.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Unpaid internships aren't all they're cracked up to be. You know, the story next time on Marketplace from APN.
Tonight at 6 here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Boston Children's Hospital. With suburban locations, affiliate hospitals, and over 400 pediatricians throughout Massachusetts, their community of care is always close at hand. Boston Children's Hospital, until every child is well. And Subaru of New England, introducing the all-new redesigned Subaru Forester with all-wheel drive. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. More information available online at SubaruofNewEngland.com.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. In the almost 15 years Marjorie and I have been on the radio, always on the first day of the year that is likely to hit 90, Marjorie and I decide it's time to turn our show into an advice vehicle. And so what we will do, and we hope you will share in this with us at 877-301-8970, we're going to tell you our top tricks for staying cool in really hot weather. And we're hoping you will do the same. We don't want an endless litany. We really don't want to hear that you turn the air conditioner on. We want creative ways to stay cool when it gets really hot. Now, I have to say, Marjorie, yours is borderline legendary. Why don't you
legendary.
Share that with people? Then I will do the same.
Well, everyone always gets grossed out when I tell them this.
It's
but
fine.
They have to try it before they knock it. I don't like air conditioning either. I'm like Christopher Lydon.
Mm-hmm.
So here's what I do, and I used to do it with my kids until they got too upset by it, too. What you do when it's really hot is you throw the sheets in the washing machine, take them out, don't put them in the dryer, put them on the bed damp. Or if that's too much trouble, because you're talking about making the bed at 9 o'clock at night or 10 o'clock at night, you take a spritzer and you wet the sheets and you wet the pillowcase.
Mm.
And then
what do you do?
You get into the bed. You now, do? The first 10 seconds or so, it feels a little clammy. Mm-hmm. But after that, you have like these damp, cool sheets. And by the time they dry, it's 3 o'clock in the morning and it's cooled off.
So wait, they stay damp for hours?
They stay damp for hours. That's right. They stay
now,
damp
what do you
for
do
hours.
When you wake up surrounded by mold? How do you deal with it?
You're never surrounded by mold because it's so hot. It dries everything off. And the sheets by the morning are totally dry. You have to do it again. But it really does work. You get in the sheets, you put the wet sheet over you.
Oh my goodness.
And it is like sleeping in a cool icebox. It's great.
So that's Marjorie's notion of how to stay cool in really hot weather at 877-301-8970. We want to hear yours. Mine is much more basic. You go to your corner drugstore. I mean, there's one right across the street here. You find $6 in your pocket and you buy one of the greatest contraptions ever invented by man or woman. You know what the contraption is? It's a little bottle of water. Atop the bottle of water is a little fan. And what happens is you hold it, you press a button. Yeah. It's like literally $6. You hold it up to your face. And at the same time that you have a fan blowing in your face, and you know, a fan in hot weather doesn't do that much for you, just blows the hot air. It also sprays water on you simultaneously. So you give yourself a little click.
Okay.
You get a little fan, you get a little spray, and it is just, it
but
is
Jim,
spectacular.
How do you sleep holding the fan?
I hire someone to,
someone
a person,
to come in and hold
like
the fan.
A college kid trying to make a few bucks on the side. When you're asleep, you're asleep.
The wet sheet thing works with clothes, too. You can just spray your clothes. I mean, a lot of times I'm home working, you just spray your clothes.
I hate the feel of wet things.
You do?
Well, I hate it.
I love it.
I'm not there. So 877-301-8970. We're looking at sort of a water cooler kind of thing for the next few minutes. Share your tips with us for staying cool in hot weather. It's going to be I think it's reaching 90 today or close.
Yes, it is.
90 tomorrow, 90 Saturday, Sunday. So it's 4 days of real summer here. And a lot of, I love it. I mean, I'd like it the hotter the better. Some people are uncomfortable, and that's what we're trying to help you out.
I like overhead fans, too.
I love overhead
Those are great.
Fans.
If you feel like you're sort of in the Caribbean somewhere with the overhead fans, that they really can generate a lot of air going through. It's warm air, but it's still moving. But, you know, children now, because they've grown up with air conditioning in cars, they don't like this kind of thing. They think everybody should have central air conditioning. I've heard so much complaining from my kids over the years about how hot it is. Let's get the air conditioners going. I know today they're going to be beside themselves about the air conditioners. They have to get them in the windows so they can have their bedrooms at like 60 degrees.
You ever dropped ice cubes in your underwear, Marjorie? 877-301-8970 is another great tip, by the way, and then we'll get to your calls. I don't know if you buy it at the REI kind of place, the outdoor places. Mm-hmm. You buy this thing. It's like a little rag kind of thing. You put it in the freezer. This is true. You think it's a joke. It's not a joke. You put it in the freezer, and after it's frozen, you put it around your neck.
Oh, that's great.
And it stays cool for endless periods of, like, really long periods of time. And I guess if it's on your neck, it in some ways translates to other parts of your body.
I got my wet sheet idea, by the way, from Hints from Heloise.
Is that really true?
Remember her?
I do.
She used to be in the newspapers.
I know.
1930s.
I think she was. You were reading her then. Let's go to Drew in the car. We're looking for tips to stay cool in the hottest of summer days. Welcome, Drew.
Hi. My feeling is that our bodies are made for that. By the way, I used to work at REI, and I sold those things.
They're great, aren't they? They're cheap, too, right?
I didn't buy one myself. Like I said, I figure my body was made to adapt.
So what does that mean?
Well, in the winter, it's the summer. I try to avoid putting on the conditioning, whatever it is, until it's the least possible moment. In the summertime, I just dress less. In the summertime, I dress more, and I make my body adapt. I see people walking around in air conditioning in the middle of the summer, and I'm like, well, I made my body adapt.
How do you? I don't understand that. Would you mind your body into adaptation? How do you do that?
Pretty much, yeah. You just become uncomfortable enough that your body says, okay, I've got to do what I need to do.
Well, I have to say, I'm not quite there yet.
So are you wearing sweaters in the 90-degree weather to make your body adapt, and no sweaters in the wintertime? Is that your theory?
No. In the wintertime, I just go as long as I can before I put on my heavy winter coat.
Okay.
In the summertime, I go as long as I'm sitting in my car in a suit right now.
So your rule of thumb for the winter is the point at which you can no longer feel your toes. It's time to turn on the heat. Is that correct? Drew,
well,
thank you for your call. There's a sort of a Zen approach to this.
He works at REI. I mean, they specialize in all that stuff.
Yeah, but he says he just does it mind over matter, which doesn't work for me. And again, I love hot weather. I actually love sweating and how I don't like being a tie and jacket. That's unfortunate. But if you're able to dress fairly casually, there's nothing that feels better to me. But at times, you want a little dose of coolness amidst the
heat. Can we look forward to Jim and his Bermudas tomorrow?
Yeah, and a tank top. I'm wearing a tank top tomorrow. I think that'll be huge in the GBH newsroom in the morning. So get ready, everybody. Dale. You're in Randolph. You're on with Jim and Marjorie, Boston Public Radio. Hey, Dale, what do you do?
I'm a theater lighting guy, actually. But what I do is I have a whole house fan, and it's built into the ceiling of the upstairs hallway. It sucks air up into the attic. And as soon as the sun goes down at nighttime, the air is starting to cool off a little bit. Go turn it on, leave it running until you're too cold at night. And it's great. Sucks all that hot air out.
Okay.
Blows it out.
I have some questions because I have one of those too, but I'm always confused. Are you supposed to shut all the windows before you turn on the big fan on the ceiling or leave the windows open? Because if you leave the windows open, all the hot air will come in, right?
Well, you wait until it's cooled off a little bit outside.
Okay, so like maybe 8 o'clock at night, you can leave the windows open, correct?
Yeah.
I'm doing it tonight. Report back.
A little cooler outside than it is inside.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do when you're not in your house in the summer to stay cool, Dale? What do you do?
I drink a lot of water.
Yeah, cold water. Actually, Dale, thanks for the call. Cold water is pretty basic, but also does the trick.
You know, I'm
really cold water. What's that?
At the cars going by.
Yes.
I would say 9 out of 10 have all the windows closed and the air conditioning on.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what we've become.
Aren't we supposed to be concerned about the environment here?
I know every one of those cars that has the windows closed is killing a polar bear. Do you know that? That's what you got to tell those people.
Well, it is supposed to be bad, right?
No, it's really bad.
Car air conditioning?
No, I was being facetious. It is really bad.
You could have a sunroof.
What?
You could open the sunroof.
You can open the sunroof.
And open all the windows.
Let's go to Kate in Woods Hole. You're on with Jim and Marjorie. We're talking about how to stay cool in the hottest of weather. Hello, Kate.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Well, I was explaining to your screener that I'm a glass worker. I work behind a torch, and I have to work in the summertime when it's hot. And I found that if I put my bare feet in a bucket of water while I'm working, it cools me off.
That is great.
Oh, I love that.
Does the water, how cold, is it room temperature water or is it cold water? What do you start with?
Oh, well, I'll start off with a cool, but of course it warms up while I'm sitting there. But you can pull your feet out and it begins to evaporate, and you plunge them back in, and it keeps your mind off the heat.
What kind of glass work do you do, Kate?
I lamp work. I make glass jewelry.
Oh, that's great.
I think you could get into my wet sheet idea, Kate. I think you're the candidate for that. You know, just wet the sheets, get in. What do you think?
How's that sound to you?
Well, I'll tell you, I have done the spritzer in the face, and I've also done the collars that you stick in water. I don't know whether I'd want the wet sheets against the skin, though, because I've already gone through hot flashes, and that's what happens.
Thank you for your honesty, Kate. We appreciate your call. 877-301-8970. If you just tuned in, Marjorie's lead suggestion, which has become borderline legendary in New England, is the wet sheet, which she says does not become moldy by morning.
It does not.
I have to accept that as true.
Everyone makes
fun
of it.
I am elevated the hand spritzer fan to an art form. I buy one a year. They don't last that long, I have to say. But think about it for me. You're driving along. You're walking down the street.
No.
You spray yourself a little bit. And it's not just – and at the same time you're getting sprayed, you have a little fan activity all for $6 or $7.
And you know, you're right. Your kids want to make a little extra money. Pay them $20 to stand all night long.
All night long, right. Because they need money for school.
They do. They absolutely do. Let's go to John from York, Maine. Hi, John.
Hello. I have a good idea if you live on the New England coast.
What's that?
The York, Maine water is so cold, you walk down to the beach, and you jump in, and you stay under until you need to come up for air. And you're good for 24 hours because it's been like you've been in the freezer.
You know, hey, John, about August, does the water in York, Maine get a lot warmer, or is it always pretty cold?
It's always pretty cold, but September is probably your best month if you want to swim. Late August till mid-September is very nice.
Okay. So the rest of the time, we're talking like, what, 55, 60 degrees?
Well, right now, I looked at the Portsmouth paper this morning, and it was 52.
Oh, geez.
So it gets up to about 60 in the summer and then gets a little warmer in August.
Yeah.
It's like masochism.
That'll get your attention.
But I've lived there 40 years, so you tend to get used to it.
Got it.
John, when you're surfing.
You're a brave soul. John, thank you for your call. Let's go to Lynn, where Christopher's on with Jim and Marjorie, Boston Public Radio. Hey, Christopher.
Hey, guys. I got one for you. In 2004, I swam the entire length of the Charles River as a swim for clean water.
You did?
No kidding.
Yeah. And the Charles River is cleaner than ever. If it hasn't rained in the last 3 days, no joke, jump into the Charles from Magazine Beach or wherever else. It's your river. It's right there. It's free.
How long did you swim? What's that? You said you swam the length of the Charles.
Yeah, it was back in 2004. It was an environmental education project. It's the Charles is 81 miles long. It's sort of a serpentine course. It takes from a swamp in Hopkinton down to Boston Harbor.
Christopher, what happens if it has rained within 3 days?
Then you're going to get all sorts of stormwater runoff and other issues. So
Make
a long story short, every nasty thing you've seen on the sidewalk is going to be in there.
By the way, did you do your swim of the length prior to or after the infamous dive into the Charles fully clothed, the then Governor Bill Weld?
It was after. Yeah, and I didn't actually dress up for a preppy barbecue in my khaki button-down shirt.
Now, that was a great Weldian moment, though, I have to say.
That was a great moment.
Yeah, it was great.
I think we need more of those moments. But you haven't seen Boston and Cambridge and the towns upstream until you've breaststroked your way out there and looked at your city.
Christopher, let me ask you something about the water in South Boston, because, they say that as long as it hasn't rained in a few days, it's okay to go swimming in the water that used to be, 15, 20 years ago, kind of bubbling. Now they've cleaned it a lot. Would you swim off Castle Island?
Yeah, I would, actually. I mean, I think if you look out there, you see the big, we call them the eggs there.
Yes.
On your island, right? I mean, that's millions of dollars and a lot of technology. And if you flush the toilet now in Boston or those other, 23 communities that go out there, that waste gets treated and it doesn't end up in the water swimming anymore. So I think...
as long as you don't have any open sores or anything, any cuts on your knees or elbows.
So we're a generation after that. So I guess I can say this. We did the nasty bits, right? The sewage and the big industrial polluters. It'd be another step from here to turn the Charles River and our coastal waters into a jewel, but who knows? Our kids might do it. They might get there.
Christopher, you have great spirit. Thank you. Well, let's take one more quick one here. By the way, the problem with a number of these suggestions is most of us, even if we would, can't jump into the Charles every day.
No.
Not on the beach of Maine where you can stay underwater for however long he does. Ours are more practical. Yours and mine more practical. But this guy,
Ron. Constant spritz.
Yeah.
Is what I'm after. The constant spritz. You just spritz yourself all day long.
Ron in Brockton, I think, has an excellent idea. Ron, you're next on Boston Public Radio. What's the idea, please?
Jimmy, haven't talked to you for a while. Hi, Marjorie.
Hey,
we're glad
Ron.
To hear from you, Ron. What's going on?
Oh, this is a quick one for Christopher. I got a wheelbarrow in my backyard that's got water in it from last year. If you can't get to the south, it's basically the same. But,
Ron. What's your technique? What do you do?
What I keep cool is basically like Marjorie does, but I drive a truck and I'll stop here and there and I'll just go into the restroom. I'll unroll, make sure you lock the door. You don't want nobody walking in.
Sure.
My underwear and socks and run them in the cold water.
And then put them back on?
Put them back on. Oh, dude, you love it. You're going to love it.
Okay.
No more talc. You don't need no more talc. That way you don't get shaky.
Got it.
You're going to love it, Jim.
Okay. No, I know I'm going to love it. I heard you say that, Ron. I will try it.
Okay.
Next time I try it, I will call you, Ron, to let you know how it goes. Thank you for all your suggestions. I think they were quite useful about how to stay cold on the hottest of days. That's a good one. That almost is like your
underwear?
Sheet thing. Good. Let's soak your underwear in cold water and then slip those babies in your socks right back on like Ron and Brad. He's a truck driver. He knows what he's talking about.
Okay. We have no idea how hot it is either because we've been inside.
They said it was coming close to 90.
Yeah. Well, everybody's going by with their air conditioning.
I know
on,
they
so it must
are,
be
Marjorie.
Pretty steamy. I've
okay.
been doing a survey, Jim.
Okay, good.
Okay. Assessing the internet with your contact lenses using functioning MRIs in court cases instead of a polygraph. How technology will continue to change the way we live in ways that we can wrap our heads around with our 21st century brains. That is next. You're going to be astounded. Kara Miller is going to join us. She's the host of Innovation Hub to tell us about the world techno-wise 10, 20, 50 years down the road. Stay tuned for that conversation on 89.7 WGBH.
Fast food workers have been striking in cities across the country, but now some critics are asking, why should workers have it their way?
You shook my hand, looked me in the eye, and said, I will do this job for X, and then you come back the next day and complain about it. Why would I ever want to work with you again? You're a liar.
We'll have a lively debate over the fast food strikes. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7
WGBH.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Mass Recycle, in partnership with Covanta Energy, providing information on proper disposal of common household products that contain mercury, as well as education on recycling. More at massrecycle.org/keepmercuryfromrising. And EBSCOhost, informing the world and proud sponsor of Innovation Hub with Kara Miller, Saturdays at 10 a.m. and Thursdays at 9 p.m. on WGBH. To learn more about EBSCOhost and over 40 positions in technology currently available, you can visit EBSCOhost.com.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. She is the woman, not Marjorie, behind the Innovation Hub. She's got a huge and great event coming up. We'll talk about in a minute. But what we're going to talk to Kara Miller about today is work she's been doing, which suggests what the world we live in might be like 20 years from now, 50 years from now, even 100 years from now. Welcome to Boston Public Radio, Ms. Innovation Hub. Kara Miller, how are you?
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
So what we did was we talked to Michio Kaku, this eccentric physicist who you may know.
Is he at City University in New York?
And he's done this, we do this multi-part look with him at a bunch of ways that our lives are going to be different in 1020, but the really fun thing is in the year 2100. And one of the things, actually, I think I heard Marjorie mention before you guys went to break, was this idea of living in a virtual reality.
Yeah.
So you already see just the beginnings of this. Have you seen Google Glass?
Yes, yeah. Google Glass.
Explain to people what it is, though, for people who haven't seen it.
So it's basically a pair of glasses, and they're a little more awkward looking than a pair of glasses. But if you think about, you know, the clunkiness of tech products and how always over time, think about, you know, iPods and all sorts of Apple products, they always get slimmer and less clunky. So you can imagine this is going to get
a little geeky now.
Exactly. Yeah. But they're going to get streamlined. So they're basically a pair of glasses, and you can walk around. They look like a pair of glasses. But you, the person wearing them, is online while you're wearing them. So you're going down the street, and you can control with your hands, or it depends on how you do it, but you can control, like, oh, I want to know where I should go next. Where are good restaurants around here? And it pops up in your field of vision. Nobody else can see it, but you can.
But ultimately, and that's the short term. Well, it's actually already here. But the short term with things like those, from what I understand from some of the reading we did, is that when facial recognition technology gets better, and we talked to Miles O'Brien yesterday in the wake of the marathon bombings and capturing the Tsarnaevs, from what I read, you're going to get to a point where you're wearing something like that. You encounter someone. It identifies who the person is without you even asking. And if you want information on them, where they work, where they live, who they are,
you
get it instantaneously.
You're basically imagining a situation. And we are not only are we not far from it, we're a few months from it probably. Or you could do it with Google Glass, where you go out on your first date with somebody and they say to you, you know, I'm 28. And you're like,
No, you're not.
Yeah.
You know where they went to college. You know all sorts of things about them. I mean, the future in a way is now. But yes, it's absolutely right. This idea of that you're going to be able to interview people, that you're going to be able to meet up with people, and you're going to know all sorts of things about them as they speak. Their bio is going to appear right next to them if you want them.
Well,
it's a little scary.
I can see that in the dating world. It could save you a lot of time because you find out that they're a married man.
How about in the business world, too?
But think about it. Practically speaking, though, you're trying to talk to someone in an interview or on a date, and then in your line of vision is all this stuff about, you know, their life. I mean,
You get used to it. It becomes integrated into your, like anything else.
I mean, if you think about it, 20 years ago or 30 years ago, people had a question about, you know, something about the world, and they went to their encyclopedia set, and they tried to figure it out. And now, I mean, I'll be sitting in my bed doing research, and I'll be like, I don't understand this word. And I type it, and 2 seconds later, I have the answer. We have totally gotten used to that. Another really interesting thing that they're working on that they're very actually advanced at right now is wearing contact lenses that will translate for you. So you go to China, you hear somebody speaking in Chinese, and there are subtitles in English.
In your eyes, you read the subtitles.
In your contacts,
Wait a second. They're working on that, or that exists?
Well, they've already done some very preliminary stuff. So one of the heads of technology at Microsoft actually gave a speech in China in English, and simultaneously it was translated. No person did this. The computer did it. So I'm still trying to figure out how to work Facebook.
Okay,
you know
fine.
What I mean?
So how do you pronounce it? Kaku, is that how you say the
yeah,
guy's
Micho
name?
Okay. Kaku, yeah.
Okay, we spent 20 minutes before, the second time we spent time with this guy, and both of us are wildly impressed. Dr. Pamahak, who is the guy who did the first full facial transplant in the United States, he's now the leader on these leg transplants. We spoke to him, what, an hour ago. On the health front, what is Kaku saying we're going to be able to do 10 years from now, 20 years from now that we can't do here?
I mean, there's a ton of things, but let me highlight two things. One is nanotechnology, and this is actually being pioneered in the Boston area. There's a guy named Bob Langer at MIT who's doing some really interesting stuff in nanotechnology. And basically, nanotechnology, tiny, tiny stuff, way thinner than a human hair, and it's able to target individual molecules in your body. So right now, here's an example. You're getting chemo, let's say, because you've got cancer, right? And the reason that people's hair falls out right now during chemo is because the chemo is very bad at telling one cell from another. So it will attack your hair cells, even though the hair is clearly not what's causing you the problem. And that's why people's hair falls out.
Right.
Because hair cells rapidly divide, and so do cancer cells. So it just goes around looking for cells that rapidly divide, and it takes them out. Nanotechnology, the idea is that you essentially have these sort of little nano robots, and they go into your body and they find exactly what they're looking for, and they only kill those things. So they only kill the cancer cells. I think that is one of
How far away is that?
I mean, it's hard to say because there's clinical trials, but I think a lot of this in 10, 20 years could be substantially different.
Well, you were talking in this physicist was talking in this piece about the bathroom mirror telling you you've got cancer.
Yes.
Now,
not
the
curing
toilet,
it, but
he
telling
also
you.
Talks about the toilet.
Right,
yeah.
So this is stunning.
Tell us about the bathroom of the future.
Because everywhere you go, I mean, we saw this. We see this in crime cases, right? Everywhere you go, you leave little bits of yourself. You leave hair. You leave little bits of DNA.
Lint.
Exactly. So there you go. So, you know, if you are, honestly, and Michio Kaku says this, if you are on the toilet, if you are at, you know, your bathroom mirror, you're leaving little bits, and they could be analyzing it for, do you have cancer? Now, it's interesting. People think of, wow, I can't believe you'd have that kind of medical test in your house. But how about, we already have certain kinds of medical tests in our house. Like, how about a pregnancy test?
That's true.
Right?
That's true.
So we're already used to going to CVS and getting a test that tells you something pretty important and being able to take it at home. Well, I think the pregnancy test is the very beginning of the kinds of tests that we're going to have at home.
So does your bathroom mirror talk to you in a consoling kind of way? Or does it just sort of spit it out like a robot?
I'm sorry to let you know.
Bad news? I mean, you know, can you imagine
that? It says
that?
You look really hot, Marjorie. Wet those sheets of yours. So
we have good news and bad news.
You know, for people who say this all this futuristic stuff's not real, I'm thinking the most ubiquitous piece of technology in everybody's lives is a cell phone. I mean, and how many years ago was it? 15 years ago? When I had in my car a thing, you saw it many years ago when
huge.
I met you. It was the size of a small suitcase, and I was so proud. I think it was maybe 1990. It was one of the first car phones. They weren't called cell phones then. They were car phones. You put this in the middle of your car. Again, small suitcase size of it, maybe an attaché case. That was the phone. That was the great advance. And now everybody does everything with their cell phone. So it's not ridiculous to think that in 10 years, a cell phone is going to seem like ancient history.
Oh,
so
gosh.
Even
7 years ago, I don't think people could have, if people had cell phones, and I don't think people could have imagined how much information you would have had on your phone, that people would speak to their phone, that people would speak to Siri. And they would do so it is incredible.
Right, like voice recognition,
quickly,
we've talked to you just in the last couple of years has advanced tremendously.
Did you hear what this guy said? That you have more cell phone, more computing power on your cell phone today than NASA had when they put two men on the moon
this is Kaku
in the late 60s.
Yeah.
I mean, that is startling.
Well, he talks about in 1945 that, you know, all the Axis powers and all the Allied powers would have killed for the power that we have in one cell phone. They didn't have close to that if you aggregate all the stuff they had together on both sides. And you can think of the enormous war effort on both sides. I do. We've been talking about some of the upsides, though. I do think, though, that there are some real potential downsides. One thing is we're going to know a lot more than we know now about babies before they're born. Already, obviously, we see some real downsides and have seen them since the 1980s when ultrasound technology became widespread in parts of Asia, that now we have a real imbalance, for example, in China between men and women because people in China could only have one child, and they wanted that child to be a boy. And it's interesting. I've actually asked somebody at the only New England center where they actually look before a child is born, and they will try to manipulate whether you're having a boy or a girl. And he said that in the U.S., people would rather have girls. Like, more people come to him saying, I want to have a girl.
How do they manipulate?
Unless they come from East or Southeast Asia.
You mean they're manipulating gender in utero?
Yes.
They can do
that?
Yeah,
you can. Yeah, because you can. Well, so before the egg is implanted, you can actually try to separate the X's from the
Y's. Oh, my gosh.
And so, I mean, you can't get 100% chance, but you can change it from like a 50-50 to a 70-30 or an 80-20.
Wow.
And he said what he mostly gets is people saying, you know, I've had two boys. I'm done.
Well,
I want a girl.
Are so much more fun to buy clothes for. Are they not? I mean, boys, it's the same old pants every day after day. You know what I mean?
Well, there's, but you make a wonderful point about what it is that you really want to know. I mean, what was it a couple of years ago, looking back rather than looking ahead, the first predictive tests about Alzheimer's came out.
Yeah.
And if people had, who did we talk to about this, Marjorie Egan, a couple of years ago, who
remember.
Had Alzheimer's in his family? Oh, he wrote a book about
Charlie
it too,
Pierce.
Charlie Pierce.
It's the a great
sports
book.
Well, great writer of all kinds.
Coming into the country.
I can't remember what it's called, but he wrote a book about Alzheimer's in his family. And I'm pretty sure we asked him when these tests were coming. Do you really want to know? I mean, the precision and ability to predict whether you will suffer from Alzheimer's is stunningly high, as I'm sure you know better than we. But there's certain choices, just like you were talking about child manipulation, gender manipulation. You hope that people are not going to go there.
Yeah, and there may be a lot that you're able to determine about your child, what color hair they're going to have, what color eyes they're going to have, how tall they're going to be. And, I mean, it makes me think of the Angelina Jolie situation. I have known people who particularly did not want to get the BRCA1 and BRCA2 tests the way she did. Because if you know you have those genes, it's very hard to sort of live a normal and happy life. It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get breast cancer, but you've got this cloud
hanging
over you
yeah.
all the time.
Charlie Pierce's book, by the way, is In the Country of My Disease.
Yeah, it's great. It's a
talks
really
about,
terrific book.
I think in his father's family, 6 out of 7 or 7 out of 8 had all.
Wow.
He was waiting to get
so
it.
We only have a couple minutes left.
Yeah.
Maybe you touched on it already. What's the one thing you've read or in your conversations with Kaku? What's the one thing in our relatively near future that most knocks your socks off? What's up there?
Well, I mean, so here's a story he tells. He says, you know, if an alien came to Earth in the year 1500 and looked around and said, you know, what places in this world are really going to be stellar? He would have picked two places, China and the Middle East. I mean, the Middle East had come up with algebra. They'd come up with all sorts of names for stars. And then around 1500, the Middle East had this argument. Are the laws of nature what govern things, or is it the laws of God? And the people who said the laws of God won. And almost nothing happened in the Middle East since 1500. So one of the interesting things is, you know, we think of America as so cutting edge, and it may well be. But one of the interesting things I think that's going to happen is the way that countries can sort of have up times and down times, and the way that you may not be able to see. He actually is originally from Japan, and he says that Japan is a train wreck in slow motion. And the reason is because women are having like 1.2, 1.3 children per woman. So there's all these old people and there's hardly any young people. There's a generation that sees very little hope because you have this sort of inverted population.
Oh, how
sorry
awful.
I asked. Now, before you leave, you're doing this event out in the world that a lot of people are really excited about next week, correct, Arizona?
Yes, it's
What's
Tuesday. So I have to say, okay, so it's almost sold out. Mm-hmm. I'll say that.
Good.
But it's about the future of college, and we're talking to Anant Agarwal, the head of edX, which is the MIT-Harvard partnership. We're talking to the president of Olin College, the president of Big Think from New York, who actually has worked with Michio Kaku and Neil deGrasse Tyson. So, you know, I think it'll be a real – and Eric Mazur from Harvard, who I think may do a demonstration on what it is like to flip the classroom. He flips the classroom. He has stopped giving lectures. What he has is people convince each other of the right answer.
If there are a few tickets left, how do people get them?
Innovationhub.org.
And by the way, Jim McCarthy is going to host it from Suffolk.
Yeah, president of Suffolk.
He is wildly excited about this.
It'll be great. Interesting.
And you're on tonight.
Yes, I am.
What time?
9 p.m.
9 p.m.
Then again Saturday.
10 o'clock.
This is a quiz. What time?
10 a.m.
Tara Miller, it's great to see you.
Good to see you, too.
And all of you guys, thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, our Friday news quiz, it's Land versus Sea. That's a Boston duck tour facing off with the Freedom Trail, and also on Open Mic, Emily Rooney, and we're going to talk about law enforcement in a whole spectrum of settings, not answering questions that the public want answered. That's it for today. I am Jim Browdy.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
We'll see you tomorrow at noon. Bye.